Today's service, I put together several weeks ago my concept, and over the past week, it developed into a slightly different direction. I thought I would be talking or having discussion about three Unitarians. Well, it turns out, as we did the research, that all three of the names that we selected are people who either predated Unitarian identity or never came around to deciding that they were firmly committed to the institution of Unitarianism in America, or in Europe, either, for that matter. But you'll see that there are some linkages, that some of their thought and some of their beliefs related to what we would identify as Unitarian or Unitarian sympathizers. As you can see from the bottom of the order of service, that this week is the birthday of Thomas Paine in the old calendar of Britain. And last Wednesday, I believe it was the birthday of Robert Burns of Scotland. And it was this week that Henry David Thoreau presented his lecture, Resistance to Civil Government in Concord, Massachusetts, quite a while ago. But I'm going to begin with talking a little bit about Henry David Thoreau, whom we try to claim as one of our own. He's best known, though, as a member of the Transcendentalist Circle of Writers and Religious Radicals, author of numerous books and essays, especially Walden, which was required in high school for many years, and Resistance to Civil Government, the lecture which was later retitled Civil Disobedience. Over his early life, after he graduated from or left Harvard, he became a mentee of Ralph Waldo Emerson in Concord, and Emerson mentored him in his fledgling career as a writer. But Thoreau, even though he wrote as if his time in Walden was reclusive, he had the 2 years in Walden. He was living in the cabin but going home to his mom and his mom's cooking. He would go to visit with Emerson and have dinner with Emerson. He wasn't exactly self-reliant in 100%, you know. He frequently walked to town on errands, too. It was on one of those visits in July of 1846 that he was approached by the town jailer, who was also the tax collector. And the tax collector informed him that he had not paid his poll tax for the past several years, as a silent protest against the continuing institution of slavery and the U.S. invasion of Mexico in 1845. But he refused the tax collector's warning and said, "I will never pay that tax." And so he was put in jail immediately. It was only after his fines and his taxes were paid by either his aunts or Emerson that he was released almost 24 hours later. He made it a bigger deal than that by recounting his famous night in jail in the lecture given at the Concord Lyceum in January 1848. It was later titled Civil Disobedience, and in that form, it exerted a major influence on nonviolent protest movements in South Africa, in India, and also in the civil rights struggles that we are familiar with in the late 20th century and even into our own day. While Thoreau, or Thoreau, as I understand that he pronounced it, he did not advocate violence in his essay. He was not a pacifist per se. He adhered to the fundamental transcendentalist principle that there must be a higher law than the civil law. And when there is a conflict between the two, it is our citizens' duty to heed the voice of conscience rather than to collude in oppression. The way he phrased it in the lecture was, "Unjust laws exist. Shall we be content to obey them, or shall we endeavor to amend them and obey them until we have succeeded? Or our third choice, shall we transgress the unjust laws at once?" He left no doubt as to his own choice. "If it is of such a nature that it requires you to be the agent of injustice to another, then I say I must break that law." Like Emerson, he clearly rejected organized religion, which he characterized as a creedal formulation, a chauvinist sectarianism, and morally hypocrisy in favor of his own theology of ecstatic experience. This became more of an issue over the next 10 years. With the passage of the Fugitive Slave Act in 1851, he became increasingly strident in his attacks on the government. His incendiary speech, Slavery in Massachusetts, was delivered on July the 4th, 1854. Instead of talking of patriotism, he said, "My thoughts are murder to the state and involuntarily go to plotting against her." But his most controversial and consequential anti-slavery addresses were in defense of John Brown when he was prosecuted for his armed attack at Harper's Ferry, just a few miles north of here. "I plead not for John's life, but for his character," he said, following Brown's capture and trial in 1859. Along with Emerson's own defense of John Brown, Thoreau's plea was widely reported in the press, which was part of causing a rift between the Northern anti-slavery and Southern slavery promoting wings of the Democratic Party. And so, indirectly, Thoreau was part of what happened was the Democratic Party split into two candidates. And therefore, Abraham Lincoln, with his insurgent Republican anti-slavery platform, was able to win with the plurality of the vote in the election of 1860. During the last 10 years of Thoreau's life, his journals were increasingly devoted to his observations of flora and fauna on his daily walks. Some have said that he was the first member of the Green Team with his ecocentric perspective. Following one of those walks, though, in December 1860, after the election of Lincoln, he came down with a severe cold, which developed into bronchitis and eventually into acute tuberculosis. In his final months, as he lay on his deathbed in the living room of his mother's boarding house, friends and neighbors came to call, to say goodbye, to tell him how much he had meant to them. And when he did die, at Emerson's insistence, he was buried out of the First Parish Unitarian Church. The current minister had officiated at the overall ceremony, reading Bible verses and generally providing a context of Unitarianism. But Emerson himself gave the eulogy by lamenting his friend's untimely death at the age of only 44. Emerson said, "This country knows not yet, or in the least part, how great a son it has lost." And because Bronson Alcock was the schoolmaster, 300 children were released from school for the occasion, and they all filed in procession with his coffin as it was carried from the church to the town burying ground. So, Thoreau was not a Unitarian in a formal sense, even though he was raised in the Unitarian Church and his family remained members of First Parish for their entire lives. He had made a point of resigning as an adult because he was presented with a tax bill for support of a minister he did not approve of. And it turns out Emerson also disapproved of that minister, calling him cold and not inspired by the spirit, but rather by formalism. The transcendentalists, with whom both Thoreau and Emerson associated, were almost all Unitarians, and most of them were ministers or former ministers, except for Margaret Fuller. So, despite his Unitarian upbringing, his continuing associations throughout his life, and occasional church attendance when he liked the minister, he readily confessed that what in other men is religion is in me love of nature, direct connection with nature and with the ultimate truth or God. It was said at the time that there were three religious societies in Concord: the Unitarian Church, the First Parish, the Orthodox Trinitarian, who had split off in his lifetime, and, of course, the most important, the Walden Pond Society, which Thoreau and Emerson had started. Without question, Thoreau was the most faithfully a member of that Walden Pond Society. and ironically, perhaps, his religious nonconformity, love of nature, and action from principle have drawn many like-minded spiritual seekers to find modern Unitarian Universalism and the congregations which actually reinforce and support us in this time, in this place. I would ask Patricia to come forward to share some thoughts on her favorite person, Robert Burns.
You gotta learn how to say that.
I'm working.
Good morning. I'm a rabid Scot, and I was delighted when Reverend Dan asked me to highlight Robert Burns on Truth to Power. He's our national poet. He wasn't a great poet, but he produced some lovely verse and ballads. And he had a very keen eye for injustice and hypocrisy and strongly supported egalitarianism. And so we love him. Dan asked me to give some historical context here. Burns lived in the second half of the 18th century. He died young, and his family were tenant farmers in southwest Scotland. Most of the land of Scotland was owned, still is owned, by relatively few people, the landowner class. Think of Downton Abbey North. But the land was worked by many small farmers who paid the owners for the privilege. The system was probably unfair, but it was tranquil, stable, and you could say that the farm families, peasantry, were poor but not too badly off. But the agrarian revolution was taking hold and farming was changing, becoming more profitable, but it didn't need so many people to work the land. And in the course of one generation, huge numbers of people in Britain were forced off the land with great hardship. Some of them came over to the New World to farm. Many of them tried to get by in cities and towns and became like fodder for the factories of the Industrial Revolution. And the role of the landowners in this was really often shameful. So Burns and his family tried and tried and kept failing to make it as tenants and finally had to give up and look for another way to make a living. And there it was in Edinburgh, ready to hand. It was a perfect place for him to settle. I think if he had been able to remain in farming, he wouldn't have been such a good poet, wouldn't have had so much to say. You all know this, but the Enlightenment in the 18th century, early 17th, the Enlightenment was raging across Europe and the New World, focusing on fundamental value of human reason, a belief in the importance of individuals, working together to improve society, and the requirement that authority be based on this. Power was no longer automatic, no longer the God-given right of particular classes or institutions. The American War of Independence came out of this, of course, and also the French Revolution's liberty, equality, fraternity. And the thinking also produced huge advances in what we now call philosophy, the sciences, social sciences, and new religious approaches emphasizing individual reasoning and tolerance. And the Scottish arm of the Enlightenment was prodigious. If you're interested in Scotland, it's worth looking it up. Such a small country, everybody squashed together in Edinburgh, and it was so fertile. One example, we produced Adam Smith. He's another small-town Scottish boy who went to Edinburgh and made good. And Burns took to this like a duck to water. He found patrons to support him, and he became the unofficial poet in residence for Scotland. His poems were pretty wide-ranging, but they very often targeted injustice and cruelty. The address of Beelzebub was a supposed letter by the devil to a group of landowners. At that time, a bunch of the tenants decided that they were going to quit Scotland and move to farm in the New World. And the landowners were furious. How dared they do that? And Beelzebub, in this poem, completely sympathized with the landowners and said, yes, you're right, it's ridiculous. And here's a list of cruelties that you can practice to keep the peasantry in line. That's strong stuff. Burns also went after the Church of Scotland, the established religion. It was a joyless religion that promoted a severe version of Calvinism, predestination. In Holy Willie's prayer, one of the lucky chosen was thanking God for having chosen him, a poor man, but I'm so grateful to be one of the 10%. The hypocrisy was being laid bare throughout that program, that poem. It was gorgeous. In Scotland today, if you call someone a Holy Willie, everybody knows what you're talking about. Burns, however, had to be careful to not go too far. He didn't want to be jailed for sedition. He kind of eased back on his support of the French Revolution. And he never quite rejected the Church of Scotland. In fact, he continued to attend services from time to time. And he had to, really, for the sake of his wife and children, at least. He may not have been an early Unitarian, but he was certainly a fellow traveler. I'm going to read A Man's a Man for a' that, a poem that most explicitly states Burns' fierce egalitarian views on power. And as background, in I think it was 1707, the Scottish landowners basically sold out Scotland. They joined the two parliaments and they moved down to England. And of course, no harm to England. It was a bigger country, more money, didn't rain so much. All the power stayed down there and Scotland was just left to fend for itself. And Scotland, the Scottish people then and today still don't forgive him for that. And one poem of Burns said, "We were bought and sold for English gold. What a parcel of rogues in the nation." Anyway, this poem I'm reading now, in 1999, nearly 300 years later, the Scottish Parliament was reopened. This poem formed the emotional centerpiece. I've translated a few words. I'm not going to sing it. "Is there for honest poverty that hangs his head and all that? The coward slave, we pass him by. We dare be poor for all that. For all that and all that, our toils obscure and all that. The rank is but the coin stamp. The man's the gold for all that. What though unhomely fare we dine or wear hodden grey and all that? Give fools their silks and knaves their wine. A man's a man for all that. For all that and all that, their tinsel show and all that. The honest man, though e'er say poor, is king of men for all that. You see yon punk called a lord with struts and stares and all that. Though hundreds worship at his words, he's but a fool for all that. For all that and all that, his ribbons, stars and all that. The man of independent mind, he looks and laughs at all that. A prince can make a belted knight, a marquis, duke and all that. But an honest man's above his might, he can reach that. For all that and all that, their dignities and all that, the pith of sense and pride of worth are higher rank than all that. Then let us pray that come it may, and come it will for all that, that sense and worth o'er all the earth shall win the prize and all that. For all that and all that, it's coming yet for all that, that man to man the world o'er shall brothers be for all that." And I'm going to add, thank you. There's an old Scottish saying, we're all Jock Tamson's bairns. Jock Tamson is like a generic Scottish name, like an American English Joe. We're all Joe's bairns. We're all Joe's children, brothers and sisters, one family. And it was brought home very timely to me when I was back home last month. I was grievously disappointed with the results of the election. And I found, I'm ashamed to say it, I found myself slipping into hostility to people that voted the other way. You know, they're stupid, they're this. I'm ashamed. This is where the rub is if you believe in honest men and women making their own decisions. It's easy, and it's easy for me as a Scot, to have totally unimpressed by riches or power. It's hard for me to be impressed by them. That's easy. But the harder part for me is to remember that we may not agree with our brothers and sisters, but if they are making reasonably thoughtful thinking, losing the place, I have to respect that. It's tough, but I have to respect it because we're all Joe's children. Thank you.
When Dan asked me to collaborate on this sermon, my knowledge of that period in history and Thomas Paine and George Burns and Thoreau was basically just names to me. I didn't really learn anything about American history when I was at school. But anyway, Thomas Paine, he was born in a place called Thetford, which if you imagine England, it's sort of East Midlands, sort of in the bulge out to the right if you're looking at a map. he didn't show any revolutionary tendencies in his early life. It was only after his father's business and the death of his first wife and the separation from a second wife to avoid debtor's prison that he met Benjamin Franklin in London. And he decided, at Franklin's suggestion, to come to Philadelphia to make a fresh start. He was involved in politics almost straight after he arrived. He published an article that condemned the practice of slavery in the colonies. And after the Revolutionary War, he soon became involved in the revolutionary movement in France, eventually becoming an honorary French citizen and serving in the French Assembly. He was opposed to executing the French king, however, and when his political enemies gained control of the government, they imprisoned him for his opposition to the planned regicide. It was while in prison that he began to write his great work on deism, and it became known as the Age of Reason, which focuses on, and often sarcastically, Paine's rejection of common Christian doctrine. Like many modern Unitarians, he dissects the Trinity and the deity of Jesus and the virgin birth of. He exposes inconsistencies in the scripture, citing them as one of the many reasons to reject the inerrancy of the Bible. Paine was not concerned, was concerned not only with the irrational supernatural dogma, but also the moral problems in Orthodox Christianity. Following devastating defeats by the British forces, George Washington and the Continental Army were retreating across the Delaware River in New Jersey. And in December of 1776, he was determined to continue the fight and defiantly reaffirm his disgust for Great Britain's king. Some of you may have seen a movie called The Madness of King George. Well, it relates to the same king. At the time, he said, "Let them call me rebel and welcome. I feel no concern from it, but I should suffer the misery of devils were I to make a whore of my soul by swearing allegiance to one of those characters is that of sottish, stupid, stubborn, worthless, brutish man." So he certainly knew how to, as probably one of the journalists at the time, he knew certainly how to label the enemy. Only 11 months before that, he'd published a book called Common Sense. It was only really a pamphlet, about 50 pages long, and it would sort of turn the world upside down, calling on Americans to recognize that they were Americans and not Britons, and that they were fighting not for British rights, but for universal human rights. Paine, through words such as, "The sun never shined on a cause of greater worth, and the cause of America is in great measure the cause of all mankind," emboldened his fellow citizens to turn their colonial rebellion into a revolutionary war for independence and to make for themselves and their children a historically unprecedented democratic republic. Now, being a Brit, I obviously been here about 20 years, and July the 4th comes around every year, and I always joke with friends that I don't celebrate July the 4th. Brits celebrate July the 5th, because that was the day we were finally rid of this pesky colony. And it also, this service has been an education to me. And when I discovered that Thomas Paine's most famous book was Common Sense, he chose me to deliver it well. Anyway, back to Thomas's story. He was encouraged by George Washington to write again. So on a drumhead by campfire light, he penned the words that would reinvigorate the struggle and resound through the generations. He said, "These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis shrink from the service of their country. But he that stands by it now deserves the love and the thanks of men and women. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. As yet, we do not have our own pamphleteer for these times, but we still have Thomas's ever timely words. A man who believed that to be an American in his time meant being a radical. Who better to rally us than Paine, who came to America for a second chance of life and gave away all his royalties from one of the country's most best-selling books at the time, so that Washington's army could be outfitted with mittens? Who better to call us out against a royal wannabe? Indeed, who better to mobilize our opposition than the immigrant writer who first envisioned true American greatness and projected achieving it by creating a nation committed to freedom, equality, and democracy? He wrote, "We have it in our power to begin the world over again. The birthday of a new world is at hand." So we could all benefit from reading his words aloud, as farmers and artisans and merchants did in his time. As we recall his words, "Men who look upon themselves, born to reign and others to obey, soon grow insolent. Selected from the rest of mankind, their minds are early poisoned by importance, and the world they act in differs so materially from the world at large that they have but little opportunity of knowing its true interests. And when they succeed to the government, are frequently the most ignorant and unfit." This week we see edicts banning Muslim immigration and discussion of efforts to register heed Paine's warning that suspicion is the companion of mean souls and that the bane of all good society. Recite determinedly these words: "For myself, I fully and conscientiously believe that it is the will of the Almighty that there should be a diversity of religious opinions among us." As we see, efforts to build exclusionary walls to prevent transit by humans and trade, to institute mass deportations, and to deny refuge to victims of war, perhaps we may choose to proclaim, as Thomas Paine did, "O ye that love mankind, ye that dare oppose not only the tyranny but the tyrant, stand forth. Every spot of the world is overrun with oppression. Freedom hath been hunted around the globe. Oh, receive the fugitive and prepare in time an asylum for mankind." If our president, our Congress, and our state legislatures around the country move against the achievements of generations, Social Security, the National Labor Relations Act, Medicare and Medicaid, civil rights and voting rights, consumer protections, a woman's right to choose, we may choose to stand up and pronounce the very words that Washington's troops heard as they boarded the longboats and crossed over the icy Delaware River on Christmas Day. He said, "Let it be told to the future world that in the depth of winter, when nothing but hope and virtue could survive, that the city and the country, alarmed at one common danger, came forth to meet and to repulse it." We may choose to claim the heritage of speaking truth to power, as we have been taught through the words of Thomas Paine.
Words from Valerie Cower, who was a Sikh, meaning a practitioner of the Sikh religion. Civil disobedience is a breach of law in order to change culture and policy. Nonviolent civil disobedience is grounded in the ethic of love, love for others, love for opponents, and love for ourselves. Historically, when people use civil disobedience to protest not just a single policy, but widespread injustice, then that act of love becomes revolutionary by changing a community, a culture, perhaps even a country. Every generation of our country has used civil disobedience as the most powerful and immediate form of moral resistance. Abolitionists refused to hand over escaped slaves in violation of fugitive slave laws. Women marched and led hunger strikes in the suffrage movement. Black students and their allies organized sit-ins at segregated counters in the civil rights movement. And most recently, in the past few months, we have seen water protectors facing hoses and freezing temperatures in order to protest the building of the pipeline through their reservation lands, threatening their water supply. As Valerie said in her recent speech alongside Dr. Barber of the current reform movement, what if this darkness is not the darkness of the tomb, but the darkness of the womb? What if our nation is not dead, but a country still waiting to be reborn? What if the story of America is one long labor? A midwife would ask the women to breathe and push, because if they don't push, they will die. If we don't push now, it is possible that our nation as we know it will die. So perhaps we can take each other's hands and push together. Words of Valerie Cower. I have produced copies, photocopies, of three documents. The first one is on blue paper in the back. I made 50 copies. It says, "Refugees and immigrants welcome here. No Muslim ban, no border wall. Our cities stand tall." If you would like to have one, you may take one. It's something you can put in the window of your house if you are willing to take that risk. You can take it to your cubicle in your office and make a statement. Or you can just hold it privately in yourself to give you strength as you make your decisions day to day. The second is a white piece of paper, which is general instructions about how you might want to contact your congressperson in this district, Barbara Comstock, and your senators, Mark Warner and Tim Kaine. The activists who know best say if you want to make a difference in Congress, one of the things you can do is call them often, call them repetitively at their Virginia office and at their D.C. office. One of the ways to know what to call about, you could go to the website called Daily Action, which one woman is putting together. If you don't want to be on a lot of mailing lists for all the different progressive organizations, you can be on her list once a day. She'll say, "Why don't you call today about X, whatever X is?" And you can choose to call or not to call, and how many calls you might make. The third piece is this greenish-yellow thing, which has what my letter to, which will be in the newsletter in the next week or so, and on the back, a message from our general Unitarian Universalist Association, a declaration of conscience about our affirmation of our Unitarian Universalist values in the context of current events. You can choose to read these. You can choose to follow them to the extent that you think is appropriate for you. Most actions that we take are perfectly within our First Amendment rights to express our opinions. Sometimes you may choose, if you think it's more important, to do some act of civil disobedience, to provide sanctuary, to provide a helping hand to someone who's being persecuted in ways that you think are inappropriate and perhaps unconstitutional. The ACLU, as someone mentioned today, has said that they think some of the actions of the administration about immigration and folks with even with green cards or visas, that that action was overreaching and unconstitutional. If you agree, perhaps you would like to make a statement, to make a phone call, to send a postcard, whatever you're comfortable with, get a little bit uncomfortable to try to do something to make things right.